So the Memory Palace, your book, True Short Stories of the Past, is really made up of small, brief stories, stories that are, yeah, about history, but maybe stories that, and I don't mean this in any sort of insulting way, probably would be seen as like too trivial for like professional historians to devote a lot of time writing about them. But you've created a book that I think is really profoundly beautiful. You tell these stories about people, about American people from the past that we may not have heard of, but did something. Their lives meant something. You tell them so succinctly. I wonder if there is some poignancy somehow in just the fact that these stories are so brief.
Yeah, I think that, first of all, thank you. Believe me, I take that as no insult at all. I mean, in some ways, I see it as really kind of core to the whole thing. And to a certain degree, I think brevity is too. I think that when I first kind of fell in love, not just with history, which kind of happened in my teens and 20s, both kind of mulling over, you know, the import of family history. And you know, I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, and was walking its streets and kind of realizing like that these are the literal streets, you know, upon which my father's life took place and, you know, and his father's life took place. And then, you know, in my kind of broadening out in my later teens and early 20s and really falling in love with going on like historic home tours and watching a good documentary on PBS and that kind of thing and starting to kind of nerd out about the past. What I really fell in love with was the kind of participatory aspect of it. It was going to a museum with a friend, or it was going to a bar with a friend afterwards and saying, "What'd you do today?" And he'd tell me about, you know, whatever record he bought or whatever, you know, girl he asked out who rejected him or whatever. And I would say, "Oh, I went to this, you know, historic home tour. I did it for 3 hours." But then I would distill it to like the one cool thing, you know, I would say, "Oh, I watched this, you know, I kind of sat on the couch and puttered around my house and kind of had this, Ken Burns documentary about, Lewis and Clark on the, you know, on TV for the whole weekend. And, you know, it's really cool." And what I kept realizing was the thing that was really cool, the thing that moved me was often very small. You know, it is the moment, for instance, in this 7-hour Lewis and Clark documentary in which, you know, Lewis and Clark and the rest of the Corps of Discovery, the you know, band of people that traveled with them that they kind of picked up along the way and, you know, signed up in Washington on their journey. You know, they're trying to find a Northwest Passage and they are like carrying their boats across the country when the river gets too narrow. And it's been this incredibly arduous journey. And they're hoping that the Missouri River, you know, will connect coast to coast, or at least the middle of the country to the Pacific. And they realize it doesn't. It just kind of dries up. And where is this? Where is the origin to this river that we were hoping to, you know, sail all the way across the country, row all the way across the country? The Rocky Mountains. And those mountains are really tall. And their mission is accomplished. And they can go turn around and collect their check and go back home and sleep in a warm bed. But they decide to keep going. And, you know, watching that several hours of television, that's the thing I remember. Like, I literally cannot, I cannot tell you a single thing that happened. I can kind of describe, you know, the general sweep of the Lewis and Clark story. But the only thing I remember is this single moment. Like, the excitement in the historian's eyes when he says, and then they just keep going. Like, that moved me. Like, there was something about, whether it was about determination or whatever hit me at 22 years old, when I first read this, when I first saw that, that was the thing that I did go to the bar and tell a friend about the next day and try to get them excited about. And I realized that there was real power in brevity. There was real power in distilling this information that you've gotten and turning it into a story, something with meaning and, you know, maybe even a moral, but just something that, like, where I could share, you know, how these things had moved me and connect with someone and kind of, you know, move with them too. And that process of, frankly, just hanging out and, you know, finding a fascinating thing in the same way that, you know, my friend who was way more into art history was than I, you know, or you know, contemporary art was than I was, you know, would tell me what he loved about the work that he went to go see in a gallery. You know, and I might not care about that art, but I cared about my friend caring, and I cared about, you know, the ideas that he wanted to share with me. You know, it, like, this podcast and ultimately this book really kind of starts in that bar, kind of starts with that impulse that sharing, you know, stories about history is, you know, can be beautiful. And, you know, and I'm not a historian, you know, my people turn to the Memory Palace, I think ultimately not to learn stuff, but to feel things. And brevity, I think, helps them feel it more intensely.
Something that also is a little bit different from the average history book is you communicate directly to the reader in this book. How does that help you express yourself and tell these stories?
I think some of it, you know, kind of gets back to the bar or, you know, or the walk with the friend. I think that, you know, some of it is, you know, I'm sure, you know, having heard you on the radio, Dana, I like you sort of do the same thing. Part of the you know, I came up in public radio, and part of it is that, you know, it's finding that tone, that NPR tone that is both, you know, conversational but authoritative. And I do think that that intimacy brings people in. And, you know, part of the pleasure of writing it and then part of the pleasure of speaking it, but also finding its analog on the page, is really kind of moving between intimacy and authoritativeness, like finding like times to be disarmingly frank or disarmingly direct and, you know, giving myself the freedom to kind of like, you know, take some more sort of poetic sort of flights of fancy or whatever, you know, whatever. But the beauty, I think, of not being a historian, but caring intensely about the past and not being, you know, a trained historian, but at the same time, like, you know, having been a trained journalist and, you know, understanding, you know, the importance of telling a true story. I think part of, you know, the freedom that provides is that I don't need to stay in the one mode of, you know, this kind of authoritative thing. Like I can, you know, I can find a mode of conversation and a mode of writing that's best going to connect the meaning of this story as I see it, you know, to the reader. And sometimes that's through jokes, and sometimes that's through, you know, very sort of direct address. And, you know, part of that is just about, you know, form and function and fun, you know, just like making something that's fun to read, something that's moving to read. But I also think that, you know, part of what happens with history is it's not just that history can be dry and so let's make it more fun. I actually think that so often just the mode of the way that history is given to us, like actually makes it more difficult to connect, not just because we might be bored by it, but because unless someone is telling you like, hey, this is important, like pay attention to this thing, or hey, this is beautiful, like let's really like, you know, let's spin this thing around in our hands and look at it from all angles. Unless you have someone kind of working to actively draw you in, then you won't be drawn in. And then it will seem dusty, and we lose things when history starts to get dusty.
I'm so glad that you said this. I've noticed in this book that there's a deep engagement with language. I think your words are chosen very carefully, very deliberately, but in a way that I find a bit more reminiscent of poetry or novel writing. It's certainly in a way that few would employ while speaking, but then right at exactly the right moment, there's a strikingly like colloquial phrase, something that like pulls us in and seems very relatable.
Yeah, I think it's about the pulling you in. I really do think that. Like, you know, I have a good friend who is a poet, and she also works in radio. And I was talking to her about how I would often go to these radio conventions, and people would know who I was and they liked the show, but I would also feel like kind of an outlier because, you know, they would be doing even historical things or they'd be doing documentary things, and they were just like at it for different reasons. Like they, you know, their goal might be to explain or to illuminate, but not really to sort of like, you know, it's a different game what I'm sort of doing. Like I'm trying to move you. Like I'm trying to make things be beautiful and therefore resonant, or make things be heartbreaking and therefore really connect with you and help you, you know, see what this person's life was really like or this time was really like. And I was sort of complaining that I felt like sort of like a weird outlier and people don't, you know, I haven't quite found my people, you know, in this certain medium. And then she said, wait, have you ever thought about yourself as a poet? And I was like, no, come on, that sounds really pretentious. And she's like, because this is what poets talk about all the time. Like we find a thing, you know, in the world, like we go through a park and we see, we see a leaf that reminds us of our husband, and suddenly that leaf is about as a metaphor for our marriage. And you are out there, you know, sifting through the past and finding things that help you talk about these deeper things, that help you, you know, find meaning in your own life. And so, I do think that, like, you know, there's really room for that poetic language, and there's really room for, you know, like seeking sort of beauty. But I do think that for people to really get it, for people to really connect, sometimes you do have to disarm them. You know, sometimes, you know, you can be kind of like lost in this world, you know, of the past and its like strangeness. And you need to be like reminded and kind of yanked out and being like, no, these people are just like you. Yeah. Like this time, you know, for the fact that it appears differently, the technology is different, the clothes are different and weird. You would be the same person walking around, you know, if you were wearing those clothes. And it's so easy to kind of forget that. And so some of these things that you talk about in terms of like, sometimes it's poetic and sometimes it's really blunt and sometimes it's really colloquial. You know, they are strategies, but they're not just writing strategies. They're kind of like strategies to like keep the reader engaged and keep them like awake and like awake to this sort of like strangeness and wonder of the past, which, I mean, honestly, strangeness and wonder is a hard thing to like, to, you know, to be aware of as a human being anyway. Like there's, you know, kind of odd and wonderful things, you know, outside all the time, that we are missing because we are also concerned about the price of eggs and that sort of thing. And sometimes it just helps to have, you know, someone say, no, look at that. Look over here. Like there's really something, and let's take a second and focus on it.
So the phrase "we don't know" appears every once in a while in the Memory Palace. It's sort of a clause that precedes some fascinating detail that we do know that you're going to explain to us. And I interpreted the "we don't know" as perhaps an invitation, maybe to imagine what the missing information might be. And I wonder if I'm doing it wrong.
No, I think I love that interpretation. And I think that that is very in line with what I think I probably am doing, although I don't necessarily know what I'm doing when I say, you know, we don't know. But, you know, since these stories are, you know, pretty far off the beaten path of normal history, you know, they're really sort of marginal because the figures are marginal. And so, you know, there's a story that I became fascinated with about this Italian immigrant, you know, a young woman, who fell in love with this man from Swaziland, you know, from what we now call South Africa, you know, who was brought to first London and then to the United States, essentially as like a sideshow freak, like a man, a Zulu who was, you know, supposed to like, you know, do war dances and stuff in a dime store museum. And I felt fascinated by the relationship, but there's just so little information about it. You know, it's been written about so rarely. And if you dive through the newspaper accounts, there just aren't that many that still exist, but there is still stuff for me there that is fascinating that I know my reader will be fascinated with, but I can't tell that story accurately unless I use some "we don't know." It's like there are simply, you know, it wouldn't be true if I pretended we knew more. And so some of it is just, you know, being honest. But what you are sort of onto is I do think that there's no history in the past, even our own past, you know, even things we actually remember, like they can only be engaged with, you know, through acts of imagination. You know, like if someone tells you about their day and you weren't there, you trust that it happened to them, but like the images that it invokes for you, these are imaginative acts. And to me, that like that's no different. Imagining the past is no different than imagining Middle Earth. If you are reading J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, to read Stephen Ambrose, you know, is no different on some level than reading Jane Austen. That it engages with your imagination, and so, you know, the poetry, the prose, the tools that I use are ultimately like, hey, these novelists and these poets are onto something. Like by activating your imagination, it actually draws you deeper into the story. You know, I think often about, when I'm writing one of these stories, and I am, you know, going through these, you know, going through books and going through, you know, documents, trying to find these very specific details that will allow you to immerse yourself and feel like you're, you know, there on some level. I realize that one can include too many, and that in fact it's almost better to to tell you one or two things and let your imagination fill in the rest, because suddenly, you know, it draws the reader in, you know, further into the story. You know, if you say it's a yellow dress, boy, I could probably go and describe that yellow dress that this Italian immigrant is wearing. And, you know, you'll have a more accurate representation. But the person who exists in your imagination is the one that's going to connect with you and the one that's going to draw you in. And so, yeah, so it is both, I think, professionally responsible to say we don't know, but it is an invitation to say this is what we do know. But doesn't human nature suggest that this might also be true? And engaging with that possibility truthfully, but also understanding that all of this, you know, no matter how true, ultimately relies on this same active imagining.
Yeah.
And so let's do that together.
I think the tone of your writing is generally humorous, maybe even sometimes wistful, but fundamentally, your writing is benevolent, if that makes sense.
Sure. You know, I think that, you know, that I've been writing these stories for, at this point, 16 years. And you know, they've been on a podcast. You know, some of the ones that have been on the podcast are in this book. Some of the things in this book are brand new and slightly different what I normally do, in part because there's pictures and things like that. But the other thing that I've done in this book that often people who know the show are surprised to kind of find is that there's sort of a section of yeah. memoir stories, these kind of nested memoir stories that kind of explain the kind of why, you know, kind of explain, you know, why I care so much and why I bother to do this. And I think that, you know, in this, you know, in these sort of experiences, sort of, you know, listening to family stories, you know, in sort of like a, you know, an experience I had with an illness as a kid, in some tragedies that kind of occurred around me, there was just a sort of like sense of that things that, you know, something that we all know or are forced to know at some point about, like, the fleetingness of life and you know, the inconstancy of friendships and romantic relationships and all of these things that, you know, we become aware of. And sometimes you wake up and be like, yes, that's right, now I'm going to live. I've been reminded that life is fleeting. I'm really going to go and be much more kind to my child or my spouse or girlfriend or boyfriend. And then, you know, then the price of eggs bums you out, and next thing you know, you're irritable again and you're not embracing that. And I found that in living, you know, it's an act of trying to remember that over and over and over again. And the truth of the matter is that it's also kind of how I see the past. It's that like, if you read a lot of history, like, at some point you're like, yeah, World War II, got it. But the truth of the matter is, it's World War II. Like, yeah. Those are real people. Like, this, the stakes were, you know, everything was on the line every day for each one of these people. And then the world was on the line, big picture, you know, and it's too easy even to read history or engage with history and yada, yada, the past and the people within it. And, you know, part of what, you know, I'm trying to do with these stories for myself and for the reader is to say, no, let's reject the yada, yada-ing here. Like, let us, like, really remember that this is a person worthy of our time. This is a person, you know, worthy of the dignity of our reflection. And, you know, it's something I try to do in my daily life. And so there has been something about writing these stories that has, it's almost been, I mean, I'm not a spiritual person, but the act of doing this and kind of engaging with, you know, the span of someone's life, or the way that time moves so quickly, is like, it's a very, you know, deep and meaningful thing to me. And as a result, you know, it's also, the other thing is, it's like, you know, life is short. So, like, why not spend it? If I'm, you know, why not spend it trying to share things that someone might find beautiful or deeply instructive or even heartbreaking, but to kind of remember the value in heartbreak and remember that this person's time was short and so is ours. And so this person came to this end, and let's avoid that one ourselves or something like that. Or let's hug our child that little bit closer today. It's an earnest, it is, the whole thing is an earnest affair, you know, despite the fact that I think the book is kind of, you know, it's kind of a delight.
I think it is a delight.
You know, it's like, it's supposed to be yeah. entertainment. Yeah. But at the same point, like, I don't know, at some point I decided that, I don't know, Like, what is a sleeve for if not for putting your heart on?
That's great. Towards the later part of the book, you referenced this just a moment ago. You have some chapters where you talk about your childhood and your family, the bout with, was it Graves' disease, or your grandparents, and this just absolutely riveting story about your grandfather in this nightclub and your grandmother. And this was a couple who had what? They'd lost a child, but then they'd raised other children and had this life that was full of absolutely fascinating episodes. When you were growing up, and did you feel that these stories were unusual or special? And I guess fundamentally, the question that I have for you is, are you a nostalgist? Like, what role does nostalgia play in your life?
I'm going to answer that first because it's easy and kind of contradictory. It's like, it's despite the fact that I think about the past all the time, I actually think that if anything, I'm sort of anti-nostalgia. Mm. Like, I think that nostalgia can be a trap, because the truth of the matter is, like, I think that it's not even just the trap, like, oh, don't get stuck in the past. It's that I think nostalgia is always a myth, you know? And I think that part of the power of, like, remembering, like, a time you had, you know, like, if you remember some time you had in your 20s, which was kind of a blast, like a period where you're really having a great time with friends and maybe dating someone for the first time that you're really excited about, and you're nostalgic for that, like, also remember, like, the weird sadness that was happening at the time, and, like, the weird fight that you kept getting into with, like, your brother or whatever. And that's the totality of that experience. Like, we forget, you know, we forget the, like, the kind of lived experience, you know, within the kind of, like, story points of our life. And I think that that's a lot of what I explore in those memoir sections, is that, you know, I grew up, you know, listening to these stories that were hilarious and or romantic or, you know, or heartbreaking. And there were sort of two things that happened. One is that I was like, oh, my family is so funny, or my family are just good storytellers. And isn't my family so interesting? What I started to realize very quickly, and I believe this to this day, is that we were just a family. That what made these stories interesting wasn't just that they were my family, was that my family told them well. And that each of us, you know, has these stories in our families. Each of us has these stories in our lives. And there's something really formative and informative to me. The idea of, like, of both recognizing that each of us in our own mundane ways have these stories that are as, like, gripping as anything, if we only sort of, you know, stop to think about it. But there was also this inverse of it, which is that that George Washington, you know, or J. Robert Oppenheimer, that their stories, you know, for as grand of a scale as they took place on, were just also really just very simply human. And there was something really valuable about, you know, kind of the wonder of, like, oh, we're all kind of these weird, like, wonderful creatures, are filled with contradictions and exciting incidents, and you know, we just don't think of ourselves that way. And boy, if only someone were around to tell each person's story wonderfully, wouldn't that be great? But there was something also really powerful about, like, oh, Abraham Lincoln did amazing things. Also just a guy, you know, no different than my grandmother or my grandfather in their, you know, in the ways that they were also, you know, for as wonderful as they were, they're also pains in the butt in certain ways, and kind of venal in certain ways, and had their blinders on in certain ways. And walking around with that idea has been really important, and something I tried to bring to the Memory Palace, that in the same way that, you know, that period that I spoke of when everything was going great in your life, if you really thought about it, there's also lots of things that weren't, is that history is in the same way, we forget that it was all of those feelings all at once. And I try to, through these stories, remind people of that the past is just as complex as today, even though we think of it as a simpler time. And the people who live then are just as human as we are, which is hard to hold.
Yeah. I have really enjoyed talking to you, Nate DeMayo. It's been really a pleasure. This book is, to me, moving and beautiful and interesting throughout. And I love learning about your own family too. So thanks for sharing that with me.
Thank you so much for talking to me.